Hello and welcome to In Control, the first podcast on control theory. Here we discuss the science of feedback, decision making, artificial intelligence, and much more. I'm your host, Alberto Podolan, live from a recording studio in Zurich. Quick thanks to our sponsors, the National Center of Competence in Research on Dependable Ubiquitous Automation, International Federation of Automatic Control, and the IEEE Control Systems Society. Our guest today is again Alberto San Giovanni Vincentelli, Edgar L. and Harold H. Butner Chair of Electrical Engineering and Computer Sciences at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to the show again, Alberto.
Thank you, Alberto. And I'm pleased to reconnect and to do another episode of the series, Alberto versus the World.
Junior and senior.
Right.
We talked about electronic design automation in the previous episode, so essentially how you started your career. But in this episode, I hope to actually branch off in many different directions and talk about many of the realms that you explored in your academic journey. So my first question I have is this idea also of basically applying the same ideas of platform-based design to other contexts, such as that of systems and synthetic biology. That is very much of interest also to the control community, because I feel that we are building the building blocks somehow, not just the control theories, of course, but like oscillators, switches, and all those kind of things. So it's possible to conceive that in the future we will have biological transistors and biological controllers and then everything like that. So I'm wondering, what are your ideas in this context?
Well, actually, still possible. I mean, one of my students, his name is Doug Densmore, went to Boston University, but he is... During his thesis, started looking into the bio-bricks. So the bio-bricks are building blocks in which you can form the DNA of the living organism. So there are basic components that you assemble, and these are called bio-bricks. A bio-bricks name came from Tom Knight at MIT, the name bio-bricks, but the concept is still the same. So you have a library of components that have a function, and then you assemble this function to build something that has a scope or has a particular function that it needs to implement. So that's same principle. Now, the but the problem with biological system is the fact that they are heavily interacting. So when you compose two things, you're not sure that the original properties of the two things are maintained, because they have interactions that sometimes are completely unknown, or they are a surprise. So you didn't think that this interaction was possible. So for that reason, when you think about biological system, the same principle apply, but you have to do more verification and more analysis what you need to do. In fact, first time I got interested in biology and design for biology was, 1987 at MIT. At that time, I was consulting for Greylock, which is a venture capital company. And there was this new startup, it's called Vertex. And now it's a big company, huge company, pharma company. And they implemented what was called a rational drug design. So drug design in... and still is to a certain extent. It was a kind of black magic, right? So you put together molecules by analogy, you know, the bottom up all the way, and then you try, and then you see what happens. And that's the reason why you need so much time to verify that things don't kill, right? Then the first company tried to do something more rigorously was Genentech. Right, but that was long and large molecules. Now, what is the problem with large molecules? Is that the basic principle which you cure a disease is that you have the certain cells that you need to somehow interact in a particular way. These cells have receptors that are like a lock, right? And so you have to find the key that gets into the lock.
That binds into the receptor somehow.
Exactly, the key that locks into the lock. So now, The problem is that if you have a large object, it's like you have lots of keys, right? So yes, they can lock and they can open, they can combine with this lock, but that's all they can combine with many other locks. And so one of the problems of the large molecules is that they may have all kind of side effects. So there was, and not only, but they are expensive to build. So there was an interest to build small molecules that would interact with this receptor. Now, the key point was that you didn't know exactly how these locks were, right? And in 1987, before that, but they at Harvard, they found a way of determining what the shape of this lock was by freezing the cell and then slicing it. It's like axial tomography, but done with a knife.
At a molecular level.
At molecular level with a knife. Okay. Mm. So once you have that, then you could try to find in a large library of molecules the ones that interact with it. And so that was the principal vertex. And the guys at Greylock asked me to go and take a look. So I went, took a look. And then I said, yeah, this looks really interesting. And then I said, but this same problem is logic synthesis, right? So I have a large library and I want to combine with this thing. And I have to select the best library. It's an optimization problem. The best element in the lab.
And once you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's the story of my life. Right? So anyway, and so with a person, Steve Tighe, was a guy who founded the company Tangent, it was called, that we acquired as Cadence. And then we discussed a lot about, you know, the algorithms and the like, because he's a mathematician type, right? And he was working on simulated annealing as well, way back in 1986, 85. And so in 87, we said, well, you know, Steve, I have this thing, and Vertex and does this, so can't we try to use this methodology? And so, well, a group of people in Tangent came out and formed what a company was called BioCAD, that I also join as a consultant, and we were trying to apply these methods and to search in the library to find the best. Now, the point is that we are talking about 1987, right? So the biologists didn't trust computers because they say this, we trust only the experimental job, right? So the tools, they said, interesting, but thank you, but no thanks.
I'm thinking also CRISPR was not there as well. So
no, are you kidding me? I mean, way before, right? And so, well, anyway, so we ended up by splitting the company and forming a drug company because we said we have the tools and we develop the drug. So people don't believe it, and so we do it. And so that company then got acquired. And the other half, it was a tool part of the company, got acquired as well by a company at the time was called Harvard Biodynamics, Molecular Dynamics. Okay. And, well, fast forward, and we look at Cadence, right? So Cadence, you know, we have essentially saturated together with Synopsys all the companies that do a circuit, electronic design. So because they have then there was a company that attracted our eyes. It's called OpenAI. Guess what? OpenAI. And they were doing drug discovery. So I told my friends at Cadence, this is a good target because, you know, that we can, you know, go into a field that we were not in, but it's likely to be a major new development, also for AI, for that matter, still in the search for a molecule that interacts in the right way, blah, 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 blah.
In fact, I wanted to ask you about it because I was looking on the Wikipedia page of Cadence Design Systems. There's like a list of acquisitions, and one of these is precisely OpenAI, and I thought maybe there's Alberto behind it.
Yeah, kind of. And anyway, so the people there are really good. So I really like them, especially the founder is a very smart guy. Anyway, but that is along the line of this rational drug design. So what to find something that interacts with something else. But the other interesting thing is that this is also a part of the research that is done at the Italian Institute of Technology. And there is a company, it's called Beaky Technology. It does similar things as this OpenAI, but it's small, it's very small. But their claim to fame is that they have an algorithm that can predict how long the molecule is going to stay in the lock. Because now that we say, okay, we can find a key that goes into the lock, the first problem is that when the key goes towards the lock, it deforms. You see, this baddish. In electronic, it doesn't happen. It doesn't deform. It just plugs in, right? So, but yeah. In biology, it deforms. So it may be that statically it will fit, but dynamically it will never make it in because they deform each other. And so it's like you're trying to put a key in a lock that changes. Yeah. It's like Alice in the Wonderland, right? So that's like famous key, right? And the size that changes. Okay. So then, but there is yet another problem is that, yes, it can dock, but then it can leave. It goes away. After a while, it goes away. And so in order to be effective, a drug, it has to be in contact for a certain amount of time. And so there are algorithms, these Beaky Technology guys, that can predict how long the locking mechanism is going to be active. So there is, I mean, we're scratching the surface, in other words. So there is so much more. But this is to find a drug, right? Now, synthetic biology is a completely different story. Because in synthetic biology, what you're trying to do is you're trying to build a living organism. Right now, we are capable of doing bacteria, no more than that, which do not exist. And so you are creating Frankenstein. So in fact, in my talks, I use the Young Frankenstein, which is a fantastic movie. I love every second of it. But to say that we are doing like Young Frankenstein. Okay. And well, so this student of mine, Doug Densmore, started looking into it because the originator of this synthetic biology, he, together with others, is Jay Kisling, which is a professor of chemistry at Berkeley. So, and then there was a biologist called Anderson. And my students got together with these two guys, and then we built these tools that were trying to automatically form these DNA sequences to build something that don't exist in nature, right? So this can be done. I mean, there is a company, it's called Ameris, that was founded by Jay Kisling way back in 2001 because synthetic biology started quite a few years ago, but it's not very well known to the general public, if you like. But for example, quoting controlled people, Richard Murray and also to a certain extent Claire Tomlin are looking at synthetic biology. So Richard Murray actually is his main research theme now is synthetic biology.
One question that I would have is how far are we from actually imagine designing a biological system such as, say, a bacterium in spice. So how far do you think we are?
Now, in spice meaning, well, spice is a solvent, right? But there are simulators for this biological object, right? So that's molecular simulation is exists today. So like this guy, OpenAI and others, you can do that. So that's easy. Not easy, but okay, you can do it, right? Now, what is more complicated is to build large organisms because the complication of DNA is tremendous, right? So that's the reason why bacteria. But it's already been designed, several bacteria. So Ameris, this company that was founded way back 2000-something, and they built a bacteria that generates biodiesel directly from grain without going through ethanol. So much more efficient in the end. And they collaborated with Total to create these biofuels that are more effective than what is known today. But also there was an experiment done for the creation of artemisinin, which is the active principle of a drug that cures malaria. And we know how to do that. So there is a process to synthesize this compound and give it in pills to people who have malaria. But even though it's cheap, it's still too expensive for developing countries because the idea was to give this pill to everybody in the world so that you can eradicate malaria completely. But it's too expensive. Even $1 a dose is too much. So creating a bacteria that generates this artemisinin as a byproduct of their life cycle demonstrated possible, and the idea is that you could generate this compound at a cent a dose. Now, at that point, you are in for a big campaign, if you like. In fact, some of this research has been sponsored by the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation because of the...
I was about to ask, because I know that that's one of their objectives.
Yeah. And so then there is also the Zuckerberg Foundation that is looking into something like this. And then CRISPR came about. And so that's...
I'm really, really looking forward to that. I mean, it seems a very exciting future for, at least for that area of research.
Yeah. And then it comes, well, gee, since we have this possibility, so how can we make CRISPR as efficient as possible? And so it's an optimization problem. So can't we use the tools to apply also to CRISPR, right? So why not? Or mRNA for that matters. So there are all kind of biology problems that you can apply design methodologies that are based on some principle that I hope are going to be what I've done in the past, right?
I was about to ask one more thing. So we talked about platform-based design and, you know, chronologically looking at your research trajectory also through papers and publications, I see that then your interest gradually shifts towards, as you said, formal methods or at least cyber-physical systems and how to give guarantees about systems that have, you know, physics in the loop, hybrid systems too, so systems that have both continuous and discrete dynamics. They're very much related. I was wondering whether you can give us a sense of your endeavors. I think here in time, we should be around year 2000, if I'm not mistaken, 2000, 2010s.
Yes, correct. So we started, well, hybrid system were the first ones and still apply to automotive. So at a certain point in 96, I formed a research group in Milano. It was called Parades. And in that group, we were sponsored by three companies, Cadence, Magneti Marelli, and ST Microelectronics. And the idea was to develop these methodologies to apply at the boundary between design tools, processors, microprocessors, and application to automotive. And so that's where we started really digging deep into formalism and hybrid systems. And in particular, I think that there was an application that is still, I believe, one of the strong application for hybrid method that was controlling the injection process into an engine. So, and that was a very interesting project because you can abstract the working of an engine. You can model the entire powertrain with an hybrid system. But the interesting thing is that while before this work, the hybrid system were considered to be the discrete part of the controller and the continuous part of the process that you are trying to control, which then is more or less the same thing as cyber physical system. But what we did in that particular case is we abstracted the dynamic of the engine into a finite state machine. And then the powertrain, instead, we kept the ordinary differential equation that describe it, right? And so then the design problem was to find the timing of injection for the engine in such a way that certain properties were conserved, right? And one of the problems that people had, the designers had, it was a sort of jerking situation in the car that would cause a feeling of sickness, of seasickness on the car, right? So it would, if you eliminate that, that would be fantastic. So we look at that problem and we think we have a solution for how you should inject the fuel so that you don't have this phenomenon. It's called the cutoff problem. The cutoff problem is then when you take your foot from the accelerator, then you have this dum-dum, right? So in principle, because the engine goes without being fueled, and so it stops, right, in some sense. So it's trained by the inertia of the powertrain, and that gives this kind of motion that make you sick. So the cutoff problem was solved by using hybrid methods, and so the algorithm that we use was kind of interesting. But this was the first time that you are putting hybrid, not separating the brain and the and the physics, but you use hybrid because you abstract in the model itself of the system by using abstraction of a part of the system to simplify the analysis problem and the control problem as a consequence.
Super interesting. Super interesting. So the abstraction is, again, an automaton or a finite state machine that models the behavior of the underlying physical process.
Of a piece of the underlying physical process, only of the engine, because the rest was still the powertrain is made by the transmission line and the engine. So the transmission line was still ordinary differential equation. But the engine, because the engine combustion process is super complicated, because you have fluid dynamics and you have explosion, you know, it's a mess. And so you abstract that into what you can see at the exterior point. And so that's the reason why you use a finite state machine that gives you the state in which the engine is. So are you in the expansion phase? And so there is a finite state machine for every piston, right? So a piston is the topmost, is coming down, is at the bottom, or is coming up. So these four states. But then does it go all the way to the top or not? Because you can anticipate the spark. So that this is going up and then, boom, you make it go down, right? And not a full... Why would you want to do that? Is because the force that exercises on the piston is lesser because there is less compression.
Okay.
And so if you anticipate the ignition, then you can modulate the force that is exercised on the powertrain.
Okay.
And so that's called anticipo. And you can also delay the sparking and you obtain a similar phenomenon. So anyway.
So that was the driving motivation for this, let's say, endeavor in hybrid systems and cyber-physical systems. But then...
No, we were interested in hybrid system before, right? My interest in hybrid system started because there was this group, and Shankar Shastri, Claire Tomlin.
I actually wanted to ask you, since they were all, at least Shankar Shastri was based in Berkeley, so I guess you...
Yeah, and so we are very good friends with Shankar, right? So we interacted a lot at the beginning. So in fact, there was a strong interaction, but I was between platform-based design and hybrid systems. And so I wanted to look into that. And then I also was interested in, again, in this abstraction of hybrid system and trying optimal control. And then I look also at the optimization of step size in numerical integration as a hybrid system.
I did see one paper also with Richard Murray on model predictive control for signal temporal logic specifications, where you essentially use model predictive control plus these time specifications. So how to specify safety, response, liveliness.
Yeah, the behavior is exactly. So with Richard Murray, we teamed up, besides the fact that he was a Berkeley student, guess what? He was Shankar's student. But we also teamed up at some point in a consulting job. We were a member of the Science and Technology Council of United Technology Corporation. And we're trying to apply platform-based design and advanced control techniques to the design of power distribution system inside an airplane. And it's also a fascinating problem because you have to, it's an architectural study, right? So you have to say how to arrange the two engines. The two engines are the two engines. So that's where you get the electrical power from. So the two engines propel, but also generate with the turbines, generate electrical power. And you have to distribute this electrical power on the plane. And since now planes are mostly electrically actuated, you want to have a redundancy system. And so you have two buses that come down from the two engines, and then the loads can be connected. You divide equally the loads. But then you want to make sure that if one of the engine fails, then the critical loads can still be, or this guy can still be working. And so what we need is to switch these guys over to the other guy, and you need to switch some of the non-fundamental loads off this guy to accommodate these new guys, right? And so when something like this happens, you have what is called a contactor, which is a big switch,
okay,
because lots of currents that go through and lots of power. And so you have to open certain switches and close others. Right? The point is that if you close this before you open this, you have a short circuit and everything explodes. Not good, right?
Okay.
And if you open this first and then you close this, you may have a situation where the load is not powered, right?
Yeah.
So you have to find what is the minimum time that you have to do this operation, right?
Okay.
So that's a control problem. But it's also an architectural problem where you place these contactors and which load goes to what. And so we use platform-based design again here because it's an architectural design problem, right? So we did this. And then UTC, when we joined into this council, had also Carrier, it was an air conditioning company, and Otis Elevators, which is, of course, as the word says it. And so we tried to use the same principle of designing these companies. And funny thing is that after many years, Carrier, they just hired me to help them to apply platform to commercial HVACs. So we'll see. In fact, I have first meeting in a few days.
In fact, I did see that 2023, you do have a paper on called platform-based design for energy systems. I don't know whether that also falls in the category.
Yeah, that's another one. Yet another one. Now, this one is for big energy systems.
That's for,
big
okay.
energy systems. So like, for example, in fact, it's done with in collaboration with people at
EMPA.
EMPA.
In Dubendorf.
Exactly. And since I was, you see, there is a research project, a European research project, which is applying platform-based design. And that's the reason why we ended up writing this paper. But this is about how you determine which zones of the town or region, et cetera, you have to connect up with what to make it resilient.
It's really about how to design a smart city or a city of the future.
It's more than a smart city, the electronic distribution.
The electronic distribution behind that. Sure.
One step at a time, right?
Sure.
So we go ahead. Mm.
And so now we are situated about, let's say, in 2000s, 2010. Another topic that I really wanted to touch on, and I'm not sure whether it originates around that time, but it's this notion of contracts. So contracts for system design.
Right.
This is also very popular in controls, or at least there's a community that...
I know. And that I definitely originated that because I gave a keynote at CDC several years ago where I started talking about that.
And there is definitely a community that is working on this concept. I was wondering whether we can clarify that to the audience or at least make them aware of what those are.
So this comes from the beginning of a collaboration in a European contract where I was doing work as well with people in Germany, particularly Werner Damm, who was a former student of a very famous guy in computer science that invented state charts. He's a good friend of mine. His name right now is escaping me. Anyway, so he was working on contracts for software design. So the concept of contract came up many years ago for software. And what is a contract? Well, a contract is a way of formulating what we call assumed guarantees principle, right? So if I assume that my environment satisfies certain properties, then I guarantee that my output is going to satisfy other properties. So it's like a contract. When you sign a contract, right, is I give you money if you do this for me. Right? So it's always considering an assumption. You have to give me something, and then if you give me something, I give you something. Right? So that's it. And so the correctness then will be if I connect two contracts together, right? So I have to ensure if I connect them in series that the assumption of this guy is contained in the guarantees of this guy, then the connection works.
There is so much system theory in everything you're saying. So interaction with the environment,
right.
Interconnection of different contracts. So
absolutely. So contracts is a way of doing a verification that you can put together certain components and that the component is correct. So in general, the concept of contract is an horizontal concept. Horizontal concept means that you work at the same level of hierarchy and you put together components when you want to verify that the composition is correct, right? So that's the basic principle of contracts. And originated, again, to improving correctness of software problems. Then we started writing papers and applying this concept to system design. And so there is, I think the first paper was in a European Journal of Control. And it was a consequence of the keynote that I gave at the European Conference on Control. And that was the first. And then I got invited in CDC and give another keynote. You know, control people started being very interested in this mathematics, if you like. You know, the concept is very simple, what I told you. But then when you start composing this contract and you start asking questions about the properties that you can assert, things become very interesting, if you like. So
the mathematics behind it, there is really an algebra behind contracts.
The algebra of contracts, right? The contract algebra. And so, in fact, one of my latest students, who is, guess where, is at Caltech right now. He spent 2 years as a postdoc with Richard. He has developed and completed the algebra of contracts. So he has all the operation and all the symmetric operations. So everything is put down and there is a real strong mathematical concept behind. So now this work on finding the ultimate contract algebra was also part of a very large paper, is a book essentially, that was written together with Albert Benveniste and a bunch of French people at INRIA, then some of my students, and then other people like Tom Anzinger.
I did note it down. This is 2015, Contracts for Systems Design Theory. Monograph in Foundations and Trends in Electronic Design Automation. There will be a link in the description, of course. And actually, I invite people to read it if you're interested on the subject, because there's, like, in the very first few pages of this monograph, there's this table that really motivates why one should look at the concept of contract. So there's a list of difficulties related to system integration, say in the automotive context, well, tasks delayed due to automotive, many other reasons why, let's say, we should make many industries and processes more efficient through this idea of contract, if I understand correctly, at least.
So again, because contract is a tool, right? So in which you verify that things can be connected. Remember, in platform-based design, there is this issue that you put together blocks to form an architecture. So you have to make sure that these components are connected correctly, and this is what contracts do. Now, the thing that I was new, and I really, my group really originated, is what is called vertical contracts. So we said that contracts in software were related to composition, horizontal composition, right? But vertical contracts are verifying that certain things are abstraction of other things, so that the properties are maintained and other things are refined, right? So this is vertical.
Yeah. How do you may move vertically, as you say?
To move vertically in abstraction and refine, right? So, and now you have a complete theory of contracts. So before, these vertical contracts were not known or not looked at or immaterial. But in platform-based design, it's fundamental, right? Because you have the refinement process, which is a top-down, and the abstraction process, which is a bottom-up. So you need to have that. And you have to guarantee that things are consistent and so on and so forth. So this contract theory helps you to assert that the design is progressing in the right way, both in terms of the fact that you have the composition that satisfy the requirements one level above, and also that the composition makes sense because it doesn't destroy the compositionality of the architecture.
Super interesting. What I wanted to ask you is, basically what keeps you busy now these days. We went through your journey in research. And what do you find exciting these days or for the future?
Right. So what I found exciting, again, the biological work is not over yet. So there's a lot more to do. And then there is a new dimension to in the hierarchy of design, which is what is called chiplet in the electronic domain, in particular in the integrated circuit design.
Yeah.
And chiplet are, you know, naked chips that are composed in three dimension, for example, or in two dimension plus, 2.5 dimension, as they say. And that is interesting because it's a way of continuing improving performance and density of electronics when the Moore's law is near its end, because at some point we cannot go below one atom. No way, right? Yeah. So anyway, and this chiplet can make a chip very large in some sense, a system, an integrated system very large. Because if the Moore slows down, in other ways you make the chip bigger and bigger, right? So why don't people do that? They do it, but why don't they do that to very large size? Well, first of all, because you don't have a wafer that is large enough. But second point, if you have a big object like this, more than 2 centimeters per side, now this one, the likelihood that you are going to get out of a manufacturing process a working chip is next to zero.
Okay.
Because the bigger the chip is, the more defect you are going to get. Right? So if you have smaller chips, then if one is faulty, you throw it away, but you have others that work. But if you have a large system, if it is faulty, you have to throw it away altogether. So it's not economic to make larger and larger chips. There is a limit to it. In addition, remember platform-based design, reuse. Okay, so I can partition the design in such a way that some of these elements that are going to be integrated in a single chip are reused several times. So this chip I can sell naked, whatever, to many companies if I make it, right? And so this is another way in which you can build an industry out of this chiplet. Now, most of the people today are building chiplet for a single product. Like one of these is AMD is designing their new generation microprocessors with this chiplet concept. But the other important point is that in addition to look at dimensions of a chip and the potential to reuse them and so on, there is also the interesting issue of the fact that certain components are best implemented in a technology and certain others are best implemented in another technology. What does that mean? That some component don't affect the speed of the chip, so you can use a, I don't know, just to make it up, 24 nanometer node, technology node. Well, if you have a key part of a microprocessor, you want to design a 2 nanometer. But doesn't make sense that you design everything at 2 nanometer because there is some part of the design that doesn't matter. And so you want to do cheaply that particular part. So that's another important criterion. In addition, if you go three dimension, it's interesting because placing one chip on top of the other decreases the distance between pins on the two chips. If you have it on a single chip, it's planar, right? So you have to put things. And so to connect this point to this point, you have to traverse the entire chip. And that is wasteful in terms of speed because there are capacitances of a signal.
Sure.
You have to wait until the signal gets to the other end, and that takes time. If you put them one on top of the other, you connect the two zing with a short wire. Granted, it's that wire is not going to be integrated, but the trade-off is still that you can build a faster connection between these two components than having it on the same chip. So that's the rationale behind chiplet-based design. So it's very interesting because I believe that the future of integrated circuit design is going to be that way.
So 3D, and also I've seen this concept of floor plate as well, not just chiplet, but also like floors for, I guess, routing and things of the like.
Yeah. No, that's called interposers, right? So you put, it's whatever goes between the chiplets, right? It's called the interposer. And And it generally interposes, take care of the connectivity of the wires. They go and connect various chiplets together. But the other interesting thing about chiplet-based design is funny because like 8 years ago, together with Massimo Aliotto, who is a professor at National University of Singapore, proposed a research to the Singapore Research Funding Agency, saying, look, this is what we want to work on, is this concept of building these components. And it was for IoT, because one of the issue of chips that you have to build them and buy the millions, right? Because otherwise not economic to do it.
Sure.
And IoTs are very much, can be very much application dependent. So you cannot make a million IoT components. But the various components, what is the difference? Mostly is on the in the sensor or in the communication protocol. So I can split the single chip, IoT chip, into pieces, and then I put them together so that the pieces can be reused everywhere in IoT except for the sensor, but the sensor is small.
Sure.
I can do that, right? It can be much more economic. Well, it's interesting because one reviewer, and he was so adamant, I said, no, nothing new here, because this one was proposed by Berkeley many years before. It was what's called smart dust. But it didn't have anything to do with this because it didn't have this chiplet idea at all, right? And this reviewer was kind of old and, you know, was stuck into this view. At least I was told. I was not there, of course. And then now everybody plus his brother is talking about chiplet. And so I went back to Singapore and said, remember the proposal? And he said, it was already done. You could have been 8 years ahead of time, right? Anyway, so this is sometimes, you know, like another paper, which is a paper I'm very fond of with Professor Lee, Edward Lee, is the TAC signal model. Is the paper, right? And I remember when we started writing it, it was because I had a beef about the concept of TAI, which connects to the issue of philosophy before.
I think I've seen it. So 1997, a framework for comparing models of computation.
Exactly.
Wonderful paper. I really, really enjoyed reading it. I actually even wrote down a quote. There are also lots of both philosophically interesting and system theoretic ideas that I think, you know, are interesting to our audience. So I will, of course, put a link in the description and invite our audience to actually check it out because it's really, really interesting.
So this comes to my view about hybrid design, right? Is when, you know, part of the difficulty when you mix and match different models is that they are not intended to work together, meaning that they have different semantics. So what does it mean to connect these two? They speak a different language. So if you look at some of the model of computation, you have the data flow. Data flow, if you look at the concept of time in the data flow, is precedence. There is no time, essentially. So it says this has to come before that. So I have to compute this mathematical operation before that. And that is what a data flow diagram tells you. Mm-hmm. Now, a finite state machine tells you what happens at every reaction index. So, well, people don't talk about reaction indices in general. They talk about logical time. But it's not time. Time does not exist as a concept as we interpret it in physics, right? And why is not there? Because, for example, the distance, call it, in between two reactions is not specified. But if you look at the literature of synchronous languages of my friends, French, like Albert Benveniste, Paul Caspi, and others, which I wrote tons of papers, we talk about that the computation takes zero time and the communication takes zero time, which doesn't make any sense. What they should have said, it doesn't matter because time is not there. And so, of course, it takes zero time. It is not considered. So they called it logical time, this reaction indices. And we had all these discussions. And so if you look at the most general notion, and that yielded the tag signal model, the concept of a tag. So a tag can be a time, but can be a reaction index or can be a precedence. So a tag is what is used to order the events in the system. And so it's like the minimum common denominator to have a description, a full description of the system, whatever their model of computation is. And so that's the reason why it's a framework for blah, blah. And I remember with Edward, when we started discussing this, I started saying, don't even think about calling it type. And so it came the idea of call it a tag. And it went, if you look at many papers after that, they use this concept of tag signal model to prove that certain combinations are correct and so on and so forth. Because it's such an interesting abstract notion. But this again tells you, you know, if you look at Kant and if you look at even St. Augustine and Plato before that, well, what do they say? Well, Kant says that the time and space are category of humans, so it doesn't exist in absolute sense. So it's a way in which we interpret. So in fact, it's the last refinement of the design process is to embed things in time. But there are things that don't require time. So a functionality may not require time at all, not even tag, right? It's a function, so it's devoid of this concept. But while you're marching towards implementation, time comes in. Why? Because I enter a physical world, but the time itself doesn't exist. In fact, if you look at St. Augustine had a small problem because he had this thing of predetermination, right? So he said, well, if you have the faith, then, you know, you're lucky. If you don't have faith, then you can be in trouble. And so, but who decides if you have faith? Because if God knows it all, then he knows also what you're going to do. And so you're not free to do it because he knows it. Well, then his point was that God is outside time. So it was can't be so before it's time. And so, and he was saying God is like being on the bridge and looking at the river go by. Then you cannot say that who looks at the river determines the course of the river. But my way of interpreting this is that since God is outside time, and time is a human consideration, then in the God universe, everything is flat. So everything coexists. And so you cannot be, I mean, you cannot determine, as you still are free to do whatever bad stuff you do. The fact that when someone sees what you are doing is because there is no consequence in time, because everything is flat. But, you know, it's kind of interesting. And this tag signal model kind of took out of this principle.
I do actually have a technical question related to that specific paper. Because I mean, the way I read it also, there's some recent work here at ETH in the group of Emilio Frazzoli, driven by Andrea Cenci, where they use a category theory to basically talk about interconnections and also design problems. And it seems like you were, actually, I think you even wrote it explicitly there, that in order to be pedagogical and not to confuse people away, we avoid intentionally category theory, but that's actually the language that you're using. So sets, posets, relations, and, you know, mappings between sets that do have a precedence relation, if you wish, onto them.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, if you look at the latest papers on hyperproperties and contract theory for hyperproperties, is all category theory.
It's incredible that it's making its way to engineering. I find it incredible, but it also super fascinating because it really embeds the notion of composition.
Right. Well, it depends how you know, what you use category theory for, right? Use for synthesis, not in the cards. Use for understanding and finding a common denominator between things, yes, by all means. But in fact, that's the reason why we call it that our framework is denotational. It's not, tag signal model is not intended to be used for designing anything. It's descriptive, it's the description. So it's something that, in some sense, puts together the concept of heterogeneous models. So in fact, if you take a data flow and you connect it with a finite state machine, why do they talk a different language? Because there is no notion in a data flow of a reaction index. But you can put an order, of course, in a finite state machine. Why? Because every reaction index, by the name of it, is indexed.
Yeah.
So you can say that all the events are reaction index 1 precede all the event reaction index 2.
So long as you have a partial order, you're fine, basically.
No, because the reaction index is by definition globally ordered.
Ah, okay.
The reaction index is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's equivalent to a natural number set. Okay, so can be enumerated, and so everything is in order. Right?
Okay.
The order is all the events have a tag that occur at the reaction index, have a tag, the reaction index, which is lower than all the events at reaction index 2 that have tag 2. So the partial index is globally ordered and has this characteristic. Now, the interesting point is that now you have to compare the two. You have to connect the two. So how do you interact with the data flow? Well, people say I put together the finite state machine and data flow in a sort of hierarchical order. So I have a finite state machine that moves, right? And this is a classical interpretation of hybrid system where you have a continuous motion which is associated to every node in the finite state machine. And then you have conditions to jump from one state to another, which depends on the evolution of what is inside the node. But this is not the most general form of composition. So there are others. So in this form of composition, you have decided what is the interaction between a finite state machine and the data flow, because you partition the two. But if not, there is a way. So you can say that you level the partial order. So, and then you associate to every level of a partial order a reaction index. Bingo.
Okay.
And now this one are the synchronous data flows. That's what it is. And then you can make talk, right? So because when something happens in the data flow, then that creates, can be interpreted by a finite state machine.
I do have one side question that has nothing to do with this, and then I
should
probably gradually shift towards more broader questions and close this episode. But since you talked about synchrony, I was wondering, and on the subject of architectures, it seems like biology is not always operating in a synchronous fashion. And so I was wondering, what are your thoughts on this topic of neuromorphic design? So things that are inspired by the brain, are we ever going to get there? Just curious.
Well, it depends. It's always a usual point of the use of what you are trying to find the tools for, right? So if you think about neuromorphic computing as a way of doing machine learning, then what does neuromorphic computing mean? It means that you have a spike neural network. Spike because the brain, apparently, our neurons are a spike in nature, right? So they spike. Right? And so instead, if you look at the neural network today, they are operating all the time. So it is not this spiking event. And in order to have a spiking event, you have to use analog concept, right? Because you have to sum, and then when the sum reaches a certain value, you spike. And so there is one big advantage in a spiking neural network is that it consumes much less power for two reasons. One is because you can use analog computation, and the second because it's spiking, so it's not active all the time. And so it's only when it's needed that you spike. Now, is there an easy way of implementing spiking neural network? There are several companies and research centers that have tried that. So IBM is one. They have I forgot if IBM is called Loki or was the Intel spiking neural network is called Loki.
Loki,
right.
I forget, honestly.
Well, one of the two.
Okay.
But everybody's working on
probably
this.
Probably Intel.
Now,
but
but it's interesting because they work in a way in which they use the neuromorphic computing to implement a neural network, a standard neural network. You throw away half of the advantages, right? So there are other people that are instead trying to get the full quote-unquote analogy. And so you have, I'm actually chairman of a board of a company, it's called Innatera, that does the second, so analog and spiking. So because they want to go to the absolute minimum power that you can get to implement machine learning based on the spiking principle. Because also the mathematics is completely different. So when you train a spiking neural network, it's different. Yeah. When you train a standard neural network and based on ReLU, right? So the nodes that have this particular characteristic. Now, the use of this is to, you can build a chip that can do this computation. And then where do I see it used? Well, where power really matters, right? Besides the fact that power always matters, but there are some things you cannot do if power is too high. And this next to the sensor, because you can talk about machine learning at the edge. So it is at the periphery. It's not at a big, gigantic computing server that you will need if you use large language models, right? So it's AI or machine learning at the edge using a spiking analog neural network has lots of advantages. So I hope it's going to take place because then it means that the company is successful, but the jury's still out, right? So how much you can do and what you can do and all of that. So
I can imagine seeing those chips paired with some of the sensors that are already commercially available, such as cameras.
Sure.
Those are already out there and one can imagine use cases for those.
And there is indeed a company is called Prophecy in Paris that actually using spiking concept, but not spiking neural network, spiking for cameras.
Yeah.
And so it uses a fraction of the power because, again, instead of continuously monitoring what's going on, it's only when an event triggers the computation.
Very fascinating.
And this is taken as an example, but the brain is much more complicated than this, infinitely more complicated. So one has to be careful when talks about this thing. Right, so that's an interesting twist, right? So the other way in which you are asking is, how does really the brain work? That is a very interesting question, in which case you don't use the brain as an example to build something artificial, but is you want to use electronics or whatever to look at what the brain does and build models for what the brain does based on these observations. And then we know Neuralink, right, is as implanted. Now, what the goal of that implant of the chip in the brain of the person was to connect directly to a laptop to be able to talk about things with the external world. If you are completely paralyzed or you have other disease of that sort, you cannot speak, for example, then this is a game changer, if you like, it for the life of these people. But what is interesting is that once you have a chip in the brain, you can measure the activity in the brain itself. So you can see what happens to the distribution of signals in our brain when we do certain things. And then if we finally understand how the brain works, then we could try to replicate it if it makes sense, because it may not make sense. It may not be feasible, or it may not be the optimal solution. So I don't think that we should always try to mimic living organisms. We should try to understand living organisms, or to take inspiration by part of what a living organism do. But we have a different domain. It's like, again, hybrid systems, right? You have two different world and you try to make them communicate in a particular way that may not be the best way or the most effective way.
And in fact, my question would be, would silicon be the right medium to perform, say, such kind of, not necessarily computations, but let's say operations at a high level? And maybe this is for the next century.
For the future. we could synthesize brains, it would be nice, but I don't know.
Yeah.
So biological brain synthesized, but it's a different story altogether.
So maybe this is now a good time to actually move towards, say, the broader type of questions. I'm going to try to keep it brief because the episode will be fairly long, but I really enjoyed it. One thing I wanted to ask is about innovation. I've seen many of your talks online where you do speak about PID, not patents, a very important concept that you put forward, and also the importance of the ecosystem and the importance of the person in the ecosystem, so the exchange of ideas like viral infections. I just wanted to hear about what one can do in order to incentivize innovation.
Well, create the condition for innovation, not incentivize innovation per se, but you create the ecosystem that is amenable to innovation. So that's the reason why I use the analogy of the white truffle, right? So white truffle is one of the most expensive food known to man, and it's delicious, and but it grows only in specific places. And mostly, at least I may be partial, but the best white truffle are in Piedmont near Alba. And despite all attempts to grow artificially white truffle, nobody's been successful. While for black truffle, it is possible. And so, in fact, there are several growers of black truffle. It's difficult, but you can do it. Then when you say, why? Well, why? Because the ecosystem where the white truffle grow is extremely important. And why is that? Because it's the humidity, because it's the amount of rain, it's because of the trees that are around it, it's because of the special conformation of the terrain, it's because of the special conformation of the roots of these trees that make this tuberous possible to find only in that region because of all these boundary conditions. Now, in fact, some part of this forest where the truffles grow have been destroyed because, I mean, people farm and do other things. And lo and behold, in that place, there is no white truffle that you can find, but it's the same part, but you have killed one of the components of the ecosystem. So my point is that the very definition of ecosystem is that everybody, everything has a role. So if you cut something out, you may not be able to maintain the same condition for the ecosystem. So in my opinion, for example, Silicon Valley is very similar to the forest of Piedmont. And why is that? Because there are all kinds of different pieces of the ecosystem, which is take one away, and I'm not sure that Silicon Valley will continue. Right? So one is, of course, the presence of two great universities, because, for example, one university may not be enough. So you need some competition, some different way of looking at it, but equally exceptional. Then you need people coming from all over the world. So you have to have an ecosystem to be attractive. And so, in fact, when we say, what is your basin of utilization of this region? We always say is 7 billion. So all the human race, because everybody can come to Berkeley or Stanford, you know, a university is open, everybody can apply, and come is a big word, right? But everybody can apply. So in fact, the students that we have here come from everywhere in the world. And so that commission of different intellectual constituency is very important. So that's another one. Then you need the venture capitalists that afford to pay for the evolution of ideas from universities or from other companies into new companies. Then you need lawyers and all these kind of guys that are around that help forming a company and accompany the company to become bigger and successful. You need large companies because otherwise your exit strategy is contained. So if you are a startup, then what do you do? How do you capitalize on your work? Either you go public, like we did, right, in the stock market, and that's one way of capitalizing. So our investors were very happy. Or somebody buys you. And not all companies can go public because of the dimensionality issues or the patience of the investors or the acquisition, or because an acquirer is very taken by your technology and he buys you, right? So, for example, OpenAI, we paid a lot of money to get it. And
500 million, according to Wikipedia.
Exactly, 500 million. So there you go. And so that's an exit strategy for OpenAI, right? So instead of going public. And So the role of large companies is that, but not only that. The other one is people. Mm-hmm. Why? Because some people in a large company may have learned certain lesson, may have seen that there is some pieces missing, and they come out and form a new company. So innovation can come also with this phenomenon. So large companies are the food for the venture capitalists that invest in the, or also the founder, but are also the source of people. So they provide people as well. And then the environment is also the scenery. I mean, Silicon Valley is pretty nice. And so the people live well here. Now, of course, there are glitches all over, right? Right now, you read on newspaper, oh my God, San Francisco crime, this and that. And there are all these high-tech companies are firing by the thousands. And, you know, the landscape is not as brilliant as it was before. Now, to that, of course, any living organism, like an ecosystem, goes through phases and ups and downs. Is this the first time that I saw this situation? No. You know, I've been here since 75. There have been at least two other times where there was a crisis in Silicon Valley, but we came out okay. Why? Because if an ecosystem is rich, it's resilient. So it finds a way of adapting, adjusting, moving to the next big thing. Right?
I was about to say that ecosystems are dynamic systems, so, and they're exactly. Definitely affected by humans as well. So then in this respect, my question would be, okay, one can think about controlling an ecosystem. So how do you, let's say, as a stakeholder, incentivize the formation of the right ecosystem, if ever possible?
Yeah, well, that's the point. I mean, by definition, ecosystem has random effects in it. And it's like simulated annealing, right? Simulated annealing, you have a random effect that takes you from falling into a local minima. So if you take away the haphazard nature of invention, then you're stifling the ecosystem. So you have to let it free to do what it wants. Now, within limits, right? So if the drift is dangerous for whatever reason, economic danger, social danger, then you can try to correct it. But if you believe that the ecosystem is adaptive, then it will correct itself. But there are certain things that certainly you must do or you can do to keep things in check. Right? And so that's definitely something that I would not advocate against, right? Or leaving the ecosystem completely free. But, you know, that's a different story.
As we move towards the end of this episode, I just have two last questions and then we will set you free, Alberto. You were very generous with time today. So the first question has to do with advice to future generation. This is a question that I tend to ask to every person that comes on the show. So the question would be, if you were a student today, what would you invest on? Say an engineering student, but also control student. Of course, we have many in our audience. What would you invest on today?
Well, I mean, the first thing that you have to invest as education is foundations, always, 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 always. So foundation mathematics, physics, biology, now is a new foundation. And so invest in that, because that is the only time when you can really systematically invest into something, because you are learning, so you are a student. And this goes for undergraduate students, of course. And for graduate students, always think about the fundamental question. Why is this working the way it is? What is the lesson learned? How can I abstract from what I see? And how I can formalize what I abstracted in such a way that then I can have impact on the world that I saw, right? So this one is generic comments, right? So it's not. So, but it's a way of thinking. And I believe that this should inform any researcher. This is what I tell my students, for example, is always look at this. Principles, build upon principles. So I hate the attitude, well, it works because it works, right? Which some people tend to do now with the application of general methodologies, which is another of this Corsi and Ricorsi, right? So, for example, simulated annealing was a generic machine to solve optimization problems. By the way, we found ways of theorize why it works and what it does and so on, but that's a separate issue. But if you look at the neural network today, that people tend to mix machine learning, neural networks, or as synonyms, which is not the case because you can do machine learning with different models, like support vector machine or radial basis function or any other approximation function. But they say, oh, we have this engine, so whatever model I need to build, I will do measurements and then throw these measurements to the neural network. I train it, and then that's the end of it. Well, you know, we all know that a statistical method like this is, right, in the end, is you know what you know and you don't know what you don't know. So if your input events occur in the space that you have visited, then great. But if it occurs outside, it's like flipping a coin, right, as if it is right or wrong. And that is something I don't like at all.
You're extrapolating from past observations.
Yeah, Noel, in fact, if you know a bit of numerical analysis, extrapolation is the worst thing that you can do because it's unstable. Now, interpolation, on the other hand, is good, right? So implicit methods for resolving differential equation are implicit in the sense that you try to combine the present and the future and you converge on the future. That's as model predicted control is pretty much the same, right? So everything that is interpolating is good. Everything that extrapolates is bad. So if you were to use a model predictive control without adjusting every step of the prediction, that will diverge for sure, right? So we know that we need to continuously adjust, right? So,
yes.
And that is, in my opinion, something that you always have to keep in mind. So always think about what you can do to understand what it does, what you use, what it does, what is the basic foundation. Because then you know what the pitfalls are. So one of the things that I always say is that people sometimes make mistake teaching the pluses and not identifying the minuses. Because then you create a bunch of zealots that just go by the word, right? Instead of critically thinking about what it is that I can do with this tool and what it is that I cannot do. And if there is something that I cannot do, how can I modify what I have to make it more solid? And in fact, right now, the frontier of research, you can read anything in the journals and so on, is to try to make machine learning trustworthy or predictable, you know, which in the most general case is a ill-posed question, because by nature, a statistical method cannot be 100% guaranteed or, you know, it's what it is. And so what can you do to make it more robust? You have to get out of the paradigm. And so you have to go towards some other principles in which you can say, well, or you have to make assumptions. So under these assumptions, then this works. So even the numerical analysis I like so much, the integration methods are proven to be accurate and stable, but only for a class of linear systems. Then you say, well, if I take step size small enough, any nonlinear system becomes linear, piecewise linear, so hallelujah, true. And that is a plausibility argument. But if you take large time step, it's not necessarily true that you approximate a nonlinear function with a linear function, and then that is a correct approximation. So that is a numerical analysis full of plausibility argument, but based on a rigorous analysis on a subset of cases. So I would venture that one thing that we can do, for example, in all these statistical method, approximation method, and so on, is to restrict the domain, so that we can say with certainty what is the margin of error. And once we have that, then we can say, okay, more general case, what is the plausibility argument that I can make? But at least I have a solid base where I start from. Yeah. So that's the direction that I would like to give to students. Then the last direction is don't do things because you have to do them or because the world expects you to do that. And think of what makes you happy And that is the most important thing. So look at yourself in the mirror. I want to be an entrepreneur because I like to be an entrepreneur, by all means. I want to be a university professor because I like to be, by all means. I want to do industrial work because I love to see things implement, by all means, do it. Right? Don't feel obliged that because you are a guy who comes out with a PhD in Silicon Valley, you have to form your own companies or you have to be a professor. It's not written on the wall. What does make you happy to do? Because after all, work is where you spend 80% of your time. And so if you are unhappy where you spend 80% of your time, you are unhappy, period, right? And so you create all kinds of problems for yourself and people are around you and all of that. And I can give also a personal example for Richard Newton and myself, right? So when we formed the companies, we could have gone to the companies at this point. You know, think about, 10% of 80 billion is an interesting number, right? But no, I don't even have been close to that. But our decision was to, what we wanted to do is to be a university professor, continue to do research and enjoy that. So it's not that I can complain, right, in terms of the monetary rewards. But what makes me happy is to be able to talk about, for example, these things with you guys and view it on the kind of things that we have done in the past. And it's not a single thing. It's a continuous movement. Right? So don't never sit on your hands, but try to see what you where you can go to and what is an interesting pasture where you can move to and have this wonderful food and not stay in a place which is trampled by lots of other cattle that has eaten all the grass.
Yeah.
And so look for a greener grass, always.
That's amazing advice. I'm sure that it will be very much appreciated by our, especially younger audience. And this brings me also to the last question that I have for you, Alberto, and then we'll finally set you free. And that's if you want philosophically oriented, since you have a flair for philosophy too, it's about the role of luck in life.
Oh, yes.
So I went through, actually, I did the exercise of looking at different philosophers and how do they, you know, conceive luck and the role of luck. So like Epictetus, for example, in The Art of Living, says we cannot choose our external circumstances, but we can always choose how we respond to them. Seneca says that luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. This is attributed to Seneca. I couldn't find the actual quote. Obviously, another one is Nietzsche in Ecce Homo in 1888. He postulates amor fati, so love of fate. So one should always try to do what they like. One should always not want to change backwards life, if you want. I hope I'm making sense of. And of course, then Jean-Paul Sartre, existentialist, says that man is condemned to be free. So once we are thrown into the world, we're responsible for everything we do. My question for you would be, what's your attitude, if you want, towards luck and its role in life?
Yeah. So in fact, I said that in my career has always been luck. But really, I mean, in what sense? And, you know, I was in Berkeley. I was supposed to come here for 6 months. And then people asked me, can you come? And, I mean, it's an opportunity, right? So I made him, quote unquote, a mistake, but this is where the luck comes in. So I told a lie. No, I could come back if but the people don't let me. So the luck is people say, no, you can go back. So then the other thing is that, well, why don't you apply? Right? No, okay, and keep on going. Like the forming a company, right? Did we want to form a company out of the blue? No, it was the companies that we're using our tools to push us, why don't you form a company? So now, where is the, I very much recognize myself in your quotes because the luck is essentially the fact that you take a decision on an opportunity. And if a decision is right, it's luck. If a decision is wrong, it's bad luck.
Yes.
Meaning that you always, and there is a degree of courage. And there is a degree of brain thinking somehow in looking at the opportunities and then pick some. And I must say that in my case, it's always been going well, except maybe a few cases, but very small. So I'm a lucky person. And But I had the courage to pick up the opportunities that developed.
Wonderful. Well, I guess this actually brings us to the end of this episode. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alberto Junior.
Thank you for listening. I hope you liked the show today. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, support on Patreon or PayPal, and connect with us on social media platforms. See you next time.